On this episode of Skeptico.
It is self-evident in the policy over the last 70 years that an element of particularly the American military-industrial establishment up and down believes there are artificial remains around the solar system, and it is affecting policy. It's affecting internal policy, and it's affecting off-planet policy. Best interpretive model for the atmospheric and sort of soil data is that this is the result of an ancient nuclear explosion. You're perfectly okay with, you know, 20 years down the track, it turns out that there's some kind of crazy, bearing in mind you're a plasma physicist, so I was about to say some kind of crazy, weird plasma event in space that could cause it.
There's
it's probably
always
not that.
The possibility of some unknown natural phenomenon, but the only known phenomenon is the explosion of a very large nuclear device.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and have you ever seen the show Ancient Aliens?
Nuclear annihilation.
This would have been an absolutely devastating event.
I bet you have.
Mysterious.
Well, on today's episode, we have quite a treat because one of the scientists that has been featured on that show several times, Dr. John Brandenburg, who is a plasma physicist, legit guy, who has some very controversial, out there kind of theories about Mars, joined my friend and author and podcaster, Gordon White, for an interview on not only his theories on Mars, but on a whole host of related topics that have to do with, well, just a lot of the things that we talk about here on Skeptico. This has been an interesting interview to put together because there's kind of a lot of different pieces. We have the interview with Brandenburg that was done by Gordon, and then I really wanted to do an interview with Gordon because I think his interview with John Brandenburg left a lot of issues that I'm most interested in kind of uncovered, so I went ahead and talked to Gordon for quite some time, and now I'm going to try and interleave those pieces in together for you in a way that I hope makes sense. It's a long interview or a long show, and I think it assumes that you're into this stuff at a certain level, but really there's no way to talk about this without making those kind of assumptions. So it is long, so let me cut to it and get to first, my introduction with Gordon White, author of Starships and Pieces of Eight, a new book that he has that's absolutely fantastic, has a compilation of a lot of essays he's done on his blog, Rune Soup. And let's get to my interview with Gordon, and then that will lead into the interview with Gordon did with Dr. John Brandenburg. Today I'm joined by Gordon White, the creator of the Rune Soup blog and podcast, and the author of several books, including Starships, which you may recall we talked about here on Skeptico just a few months ago. And ever since that show and ever since meeting Gordon, I've stayed in touch because I've really, really loved some of the things that he's bringing forward and a lot of his ideas. So I've pestered him since then that we ought to do something together. And I eventually wrangled him into doing an interview. And he has a great one he's bringing to us today with Dr. John Brandenburg. And what I really wanted to do today was not only bring you that interview, but talk with Gordon, because there's so many things about that interview I thought were fantastic that might slip past you if you're not into this topic. So I'm super excited to have Gordon on. Gordon, welcome to Skeptico, and thanks for joining us, and thanks for bringing us this great interview with John Brandenburg.
Well, it was an absolute pleasure pretending to be you for about 90 minutes, Alex. It was really fun. Thank you again.
No, I think you can't play it off like that, man. It's all you. Good or bad, you're going to have to
good
own.
Or bad. Yeah, all right. I'll take that.
So let's set this up a little bit. You know, Gordon, if folks don't remember our interview and aren't familiar with you, you're someone who has a broad range of interest in kind of controversial archaeology, controversial leading edge history, parapsychology. And you come at it, of course, from this thing called chaos magic, which is kind of your point of entry. But what really kind of brings us together is that although I'm usually coming at things from this kind of consciousness, science, spirituality thing, what seems to really drive both of us, if you get to the core of what we're talking about, is this common ground on this idea that we ought to be looking at the biggest picture questions, if you want to call them science questions. That is, who are we and why are we here? And we always have to come back to those questions, number one. And if that isn't unique, I think what does really bring us together is our understanding that that journey to really say, okay, we're going to tackle those big picture questions is going to get messy, because once we get in there, we find out how difficult it is to shake people from their cherished beliefs. We get into all sorts of conspiracies. We get into all sorts of distorted and misinformation that's thrown around with history. And I just think, you know, maybe you want to comment on that, but I think it's interesting that your show and your books can come at things from one perspective, and I'm really coming at them from another. And I thought it's so cool that we found, you know, a real kindred kind of way to talk about this that is totally in sync. So do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. I think we're both blind men, you know, fondling the same elephant at this point in time, because there is, if we do, and I think this is a belief we share, if we do need to or want to move the discourse, it does actually need data and evidence behind it. And that sort of rigor is, I think, a shared way of approaching the elephant. And I think that's why there's a general alignment in a lot of the things we're interested in and their implications. And you're completely right that it doesn't really matter what angle you come at this element from. What ends up happening is you quickly discover that money and power and politics are intimately involved in it, because this is the truth with a capital T is very valuable. You either get to produce it or control it. And it's one of the sort of eternal human conditions in a way, really.
Good. And, you know, the reason we're going to kind of go into a little bit more of an introduction than I think we normally would is because I think this interview that you've done with John Brandenburg requires a little bit of contextualization to really make it mean something. So before we start with Dr. Brandenburg's theories, which are extremely controversial and can kind of take us in a million places, how about we introduce people to who the guy is, basic bio? Do you want to kind of tell us who he is? And I have his credentials here, so if you want me to read those, I can read those as well. But tell us who John Brandenburg is.
Sure. So Dr. Brandenburg is a plasma physicist who has spent any number of years, the last several decades, occasionally with top secret clearance, occasionally not, working in the sort of privatized space program. So he's ex-JPL. He's worked on the Clementine mission. He's worked in some of the companies that sort of fed into the Reagan Star Wars program, and that's been his career. In addition to that, he has been part of the people in the kind of early 80s constellating around someone like Richard Hoagland. I call them the Mars nerds, and I say it with affection, but this is a collection of people in that world, so with a science background, but independently researching some of the anomalous information that started to come out following 1976, Voyager. So Voyager 76, following some of the images we saw of Mars, and that kind of information became quite controversial in the early 90s, and then a fairly flimsy hit job was put on it, and it's never really returned to popular consciousness outside of a few movies again in the 90s. So Dr. Brandenburg is a real-life up-and-down scientist and of the hard science variety who is also, and this is one of the things, funnily enough, we've spoken about this with regards to other potential guests, Alex, but there are aspects of him as a person that, lead me to have a kind of different layer of trust with him, in that he freely admits that, and I think this is, you know, fair and a nice thing to say about someone, but he freely admits he's a patriot. He freely admits that he's a Christian. So we're dealing with someone who not only knows his apples, but like his God won't let him lie. Now, whether or not he's your God or mine, like I do believe that counts for something, especially when you're dealing with a world of such circuitous co-intel and disinformation. You have someone who is an up and down all-American Christian who also happens to be very good and very and has the personality type of a hard scientist.
Yeah, and there's a couple of different interesting aspects of that that we can get into. Let me just fill in one detail. I mean, you say hard scientist. If you scan the internet for this guy, you're liable to see, as you always will on anything that's interesting, you know, a lampooning of him in a number of different ways. Let's be clear. Cal Davis, PhD, theoretical plasma physics from Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories. That's top notch, folks. I mean, that's the real deal. That's a nerdy scientist. Sandia Labs, JPL, all the places, rubbing shoulders with Carl Sagan, you know, personal relationship, exchanging emails and telephone calls, and Richard Hoagland. This is the real deal. So if you do run across, you know, that 90-second Google search and this guy is portrayed as some kind of buffoon, that's not the case. As a matter of fact, you know what? I just have to share this little bit of a story. When I had a job over the summer when I was in graduate school with Texas Instruments in Dallas, long, long time ago. And I didn't know anything. You know, I just didn't know anything. And I went there and I thought Texas Instruments, so they make these little calculators, you know. Well, no. I mean, Texas Instruments is a huge defense contractor, you know. And when you get into the belly of the beast there, like you work in this little world, like I didn't have any kind of clearance or anything like that. So you're in this little compartmentalized world. And then they're all 90% of us in this glassed off thing, you know, with these people that you never see and never talk to. But you did have some interaction with them. And at Texas Instruments, everyone wore their badge, their ID badge proudly, and it was colored to show both your seniority and your security, you know. So the gold badgers were the people who had 20 years, and the gold badgers with medals would have like 25 or 30 years. And when I saw Brandenburg, even when I saw him for the first time in some of his video presentations, he reminded me of those kind of nerdy kind of guys who were deep into their science and at the same time deep into this military industrial complex thing that just breeds this kind of a little bit goofiness that is kind of hard to really put your finger on, but they kind of laugh a little bit more at the kind of the wrong things sometimes. They just don't have quite the smoothness, I guess, that you see with some of the more slick people who are in the ivory tower and are generally, you know, on the TV circuit and stuff like that. And that is not to disparage him in any way. It's just,
of course not. It's a personality difference. With academics, there are the ones that are paid to talk, as in there are those whose job it is to stand in front of an auditorium of students and essentially, ideally, charm them into learning things. And then, there are the other scientists who they're like doing the work. It's a personality type thing. He's a great guy. I really enjoyed my chat with him. I follow his data. I believe, I don't think he's lying. I can guarantee you that. As a matter of fact, I think that's fairly open and shut. As to his interpretation, that's his own. Depart from him in some of the interpretations of it, but he's certainly a unique character compared to, if you're not familiar with the world, he's definitely that kind of character. Dr. Brandenburg, welcome to Skeptico. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, well, it's a great pleasure and honor to be here.
Wonderful. So we've just been chatting offline. I'm a huge fan of your work. I'm a huge fan of your book, but for listeners who may be coming to your research brand new, would you mind giving us a bit of a sort of overview of your background?
I grew up in America. I'm a product of a very standard American upbringing, And my father encouraged me to go into physics, as my uncle was also a physicist. So my primary mission in life has been to be a physicist working on plasmas for energy, fusion energy, and also for national defense and space. And by the way, if a plasma physicist can't work on fusion, the first thing he does is he goes into space. It's just like if you can't make money shipping cargo, you become a pirate.
Yeah.
Okay, so now that we know who Dr. John Brandenburg is, let's move into the main points I think that come out of the interview. And again, I'm going to first talk about those with Gordon White. So the first one would be this idea of reclaiming history. I think you'll see what I mean. Here goes. When you joined me to talk about your fabulous book, Starships, that's what I felt you had really nailed completely, is this idea that there is a history here. There's a lot of known data points associated with that history. And all we have to do is connect the dots on those data points, and we can reclaim that history. And I think you tried to do the same thing in this interview. Talk about reclaiming this history about our space program and about Mars in particular.
Sure. So you're completely right, Alex, that in the early 20th century, it was sort of self-evident that we assumed that when we eventually got to Mars, or when we built a telescope that was powerful enough to see things, that we would see ruins and the remains of a civilization, or even one that still existed. And that was normal. That was New York Times stuff. It didn't break civilization. There's this kind of meme in ufology that the quote-unquote reason why this stuff is covered up is because civilization will collapse. That's not correct. We thought that beforehand. But somewhere in the mid-20th century, the presence of artificial structures elsewhere in the solar system became a national security interest. And that happened with the formation of NASA. NASA emerged. NASA is essentially a paramilitary organization in that it is a publicly funded scientific, government-funded scientific body, unless it finds something of national security importance, and then it becomes military again. But the space program for the first 11 years in the U.S. was military, and NASA emerged out of that, and it had, former SS Major Wernher von Braun as running the Apollo program and so on. So baked into NASA at the beginning of, the middle of the 20th century, beginning of the Cold War, is this notion that let us explore space when it becomes the clue is when, because this is in NASA's foundational policy documents from the likes of the Brookings Institute. When we find something, it is of national security implications, and that will make that top secret.
So here then is Gordon and Dr. John Brandenburg on reclaiming space history.
Mars always fascinated me as a child growing up in the space age in America, where we were mesmerized by the Mercury, the moon race, the whole drama of the Mercury program, the Gemini program, finally Apollo, the landing on the moon, and watching, of course, the Russians be ahead at first and then struggle, the very brave cosmonauts out there in space also, and finally fall behind with the destruction of their big N1 rocket, so they couldn't make it to the moon, whereas we did. And in the middle of this is Wernher von Braun, a rather anomalous character. Didn't he used to work for the Nazis? Was sort of the question that came to my mind when I was a kid. And but there he was, now transformed into an all-American hero. And he wants to go to the moon, but he really wants to go to Mars. That is his real goal. And then he says something very cryptic in the middle after landing on the moon successfully. He says, the first people we should send to Mars should include archaeologists. And I remember hearing of that when I was young and thinking, that's a peculiar thing to say. But at the time, The NASA, the U.S. government was heavily influenced by the work of Percival Lowell, as it turns out. And even though many scientists discarded the work of Percival Lowell, and, of course, the canals, within the U.S. government, there was a kind of view that, well, Percival Lowell may very well have been right, because Mars gave the appearance of being a planet that was once like Earth. I mean, we found, upon investigation on Mars, the first thing we saw was craters, and that was when we didn't see any canals. We found a lot of craters, and so we're sending probes to Mars in addition to the big moon race, the big drama of the moon race. And it's every American knew that our eventual goal was to go to Mars, and all the science fiction movies were about going to Mars and finding civilizations there and everything like that. It was all very I don't know how many grade B science fiction movies I saw about going to Mars as a kid. And Saturday afternoon matinee, popcorn and a hot dog for lunch. That was the way to spend the afternoon in my hometown.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Wernher von Braun quote is interesting. And when you mention the sort of widespread belief in canals on Mars, it really was widespread. I mean, the New York Times in I believe it was the 30s, was running articles about hypothetically how we could communicate with these evident cultures on Mars by doing things like burning pie into the grasslands in Eurasia so that they could potentially see it. So it's always struck me as very interesting, and we'll get onto this story in the show. It's always struck me as very interesting, in the first half of the 20th century, it was taken as self-evident and not that big of a deal that there was either an existing culture on Mars or previous cultures on Mars. And it's only as we move into the Cold War period or the post-war period that that starts to get a bit fishy, but it's important. Your Wernher von Braun quote is correct. It's not just there. I mean, it's NASA's founding documents. Well, NASA's, the think tanks that were providing sort of strategy to NASA had in them the expectation that we would find ruined artifacts. It was part of NASA's DNA from the beginning that we would find this stuff.
It was our expectation that we'd find ruined artifacts on Mars.
Yeah, absolutely. So from the beginning, it hasn't been that odd of an idea. And you've been, I mean, you are a plasma physicist, but you have worked in some of the companies directly, over the course of your career that have been involved in this kind of, you know, in this off-planet science.
Yes, absolutely. I was part of the Clementine, mission to the moon, where we found billions of tons of, frozen ice at the poles of the moon, enough to support a large human. The moon basically has everything required to sustain a human population except water. And now, after the Clementine mission, it became apparent that it had everything that you could support a large lunar colony on the moon, because there was an abundance of water, certainly enough for a small technologically intensive society to exist there. So my background, I basically went to school as to major in physics, and I eventually then went on, I was good at it, and then I went on to work on plasma physics for energy, fusion energy, a problem that still fascinates me. And my goal at the time, you must remember that the energy crisis became very acute in our country after the 73 war, when the oil was embargoed. So to me, to work on energy was part of my task of defending the country. And I've always been a very patriotic sort of character. All of my uncles fought in World War II in the combat. So it was just a family tradition that we would serve the country in one capacity or another. So I then became a plasma physicist and got my master's and then PhD. after my finishing my four-year bachelor's degree. Then the funding mysteriously for fusion energy suddenly kind of dried up under the Reagan administration, and all of us were basically plasma physicists who had trained to work on making a brighter, warmer future for humanity were basically dragooned into working on directed energy weapons for the Star Wars defense in space. But I had, by that time, become very interested in Mars. I'd become so fascinated with the apparent artifacts that had been found on Mars in 1976, the face on Mars and the pyramid next to it in Cydonia, which I found out later was supposed to be the prime landing site of the Viking missions. The Viking missions were, after our Apollo moon mission success, were just a capstone on American kind of space supremacy. Basically, we landed on Mars, something the Russians had not been successful at doing. First thing we did is sample the atmosphere and look at its isotopic composition. That's where the U.S. government apparently discovered a big surprise. But also they photographed, they had begun photographing Mars at close range under the Mariners. They had discovered all these extinct water channels, confirming this picture of Mars as a past, of having an Earth-like past.
The Mariner mission, just to jump in there, Dr. Brandenburg, before we talk about the sort of crazy politics that goes around the photographing of the face on Mars, but it's my understanding that armed guards showed up at JPL's photo lab when Mariner was still 2 weeks out from the planet. So from the very beginning, we know that they were expecting to find something that needed to be...
They were expecting to find a dead civilization on Mars. I talked to people who had retired from Jet Propulsion Lab who were... they were helping on the Clementine mission to the moon by that time in the late 80s, and they said that the Mariner 9 was going to go into close orbit around Mars and take very high-resolution pictures of the surface. And suddenly armed guards showed up at all the photo labs so that no photographs could come out of there without official sanction. In other words, the mission to Mars became partly classified. And yes, it is evident that the U.S. government expected, or at least entertained a strong possibility that they were going to find a dead civilization on Mars. One thing they had found out from the earlier flyby missions of Mars is even though there were craters on Mars, there were a lot less craters than they actually had reason to expect. And Carl Sagan pointed out this meant some past erosion, like on Earth, had occurred on massive erosion occurred on Mars. In other words, Mars did not look like the moon. It was actually rather sparsely cratered, and it's next to the asteroid belt. You would have expected it to be heavily cratered if it didn't have an Earth-like past. But since it was only sparsely cratered, that meant something had gone through just like an eraser on a chalkboard, erased all of the old craters. So only a few new ones had been able to be preserved. So the U.S. government expected, or at least thought there was a strong possibility they would find a dead civilization on Mars.
We'll go on to the next point. I was thinking of the movie A Few Good Men, where Jack Nicholson is on the stand and Tom Cruise is saying, "I want the truth." And he says, "You can't handle the truth." You know, and he sneers in the camera. And what I think is so awesome about that is we live in a you can't handle the truth world. And by that, I mean, we accept that we can't handle the truth. And when they tell us, move on, you don't want to know this. What they're really saying is true. You really don't want to know the truth. I found that on this show is that, you know, you encounter people and we encounter them in day-to-day life, or you encounter them when you do an interview show like this and you talk to people who have opposing views and you go, what about the data? And they just don't want to go there. So if you want to talk about 9/11 and you want to talk about it's proven that there was foreknowledge because there was all this stock trading and we can go and look at it, they don't want to go there because they don't want to even contemplate the idea that their government could do some of these things that they know that their government can do. So it, to me, it's almost like a catch-22 in that you can't handle the truth. What is the truth? The truth is you can't handle the truth. You know, and it just goes around and around in a circle because the truth is knowable. And that's what I think was one of your opening remarks to this interview, is that you like to come back to the data. You like to come back to the history, whether it's archaeology or history or whatever. And the data here, folks, is pretty easy to put your hands on and pretty easy to verify some of the extraordinary things that Brandenburg is saying in this interview. And the truth is, you don't go there because you really can't handle the truth. That's the only thing that's keeping people back.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I told a story on a podcast that I was on over the weekend. I have a friend of mine, very dear friend. She's extremely intelligent. She used to work for the Financial Times and so on. And speaking of Wernher von Braun, I just happened to mention that the guy who ran the Apollo program, now this isn't forbidden history in any way, this is just in the books, you'll find it on Wikipedia, was an SS major for the Nazis. And she just couldn't, literally could not handle the truth. Like, her mind just rejected it.
SS, when all that means, I mean, you know.
And he joined, this idea that he was a good Nazi is probably not correct, because he was a believer. He joined 2 years before the war. So he leapt in. He wasn't defending his country. He's like, no, Mr. Hitler, I think I like what you do. And that just messed with her head. She, and it's to your point about not being able to handle the truth. It's an almost a Gnostic realization that the reality of people, it's extremely dissociative to sort of experience that a government or a faction within the government sees this. And when it comes to what we're talking about in space, Here's how one thing is verifiable. We can prove, based on this conversation and some casual research afterwards, that there is a section of the Anglo-American military that up and down believes there are artificial remains elsewhere in the solar system. Whether there are or not is actually, frankly, open to interpretation. But the policy changes, it is self-evident in the policy over the last 70 years that an element of particularly the American military-industrial establishment up and down believes there are artificial remains around the solar system, and it is affecting policy. It's affecting internal policy, and it's affecting off-planet policy.
Real science in the big leagues, especially when there's big things at stake, like the human place in the cosmos, it gets very personal. And people don't always play by the rules that you're taught in grade school about how the scientific method works.
Oh, yes, you're singing the Skeptico theme song here.
Sometimes it's more like silverback gorillas roaring at each other in the forest and pounding their chests at each other than it is a scientific discourse.
Absolutely. Now let's go back to when, to 1976, where I think I'm in agreement on this. This is when, at a U.S. government or deep state level, they have definitive proof.
Yes, that suddenly they know, they in fact take a picture of the face in Cydonia. Everybody sees it looks like a face. At a certain level, the U.S. government has been expecting to find something like that. In fact, they found two pyramids at Elysium earlier, and they actually took two pictures. I have them in the book. They came back around and with great difficulty managed to snap pictures of the pyramids at morning, whereas the earlier picture was in late afternoon, and confirmed that these were pyramids. I think to anyone in the U.S. government, we're talking administrators and military officials, they would just look at this and say, well, that looks like a pyramid to me. And so you know, hence they knew that they had discovered. Their earlier expectation was being rewarded. By the time of 1976, when they took a picture of the face on Mars at Cydonia, and then 1 month later, they brought the spacecraft again around and took a second confirming shot at a different lighting, the famous frame 7813. And this clearly shows there's a pyramid, a five-sided pyramid near the face within about 5 kilometers. And so therefore, in fact, everything is settled at that point. In the minds of people who are used to doing science in the big leagues, that means bingo. We have it.
Absolutely. From the minds of people who don't understand science very well, like science journalists, that's not actually the case. Because when you're talking about additional photos of Cydonia, some of the other anecdotes you have in the book and around your involvement with independent Mars researchers like Richard Hoagland and Vince DiPietro, Vince almost came to blows over some of the attempted takedowns of the Cydonia face. And I think it's probably important that we talk about that, because I'm just thinking of the listeners out there who may have been following along. The last thing they will remember about the face on Mars, I'm just thinking in their head now, they're like, hang on, didn't we take another photo and it was just a funny shaped hill? So I think we need to tell that story just so that we know, no, that was a takedown.
No, it was, it was an intense, reaction from the kind of academic types running JPL, and they're probably also following orders, suppress this idea. The U.S. government for a long time decided to, hold off the inevitable, basically. It was funny, their actions were the right hand and the left hand. The right hand of the government was distributing all these photos to everybody, making them available. They clearly showed evidence for a dead civilization on Mars. And the left hand, the more programmatic, big science, empire building sort of part of science, was adamant that this was nothing, that it's just a funny shaped hill. There's nothing unusual about it. And in fact, when DiPietro and Molinar found a second image of the face in Cydonia from the Viking, which, clearly shows a face, and then there's a pyramid right next to it. And you can actually then go back to the original discovery frame and find the same pyramid. In fact, so they, the initial reaction from Jet Propulsion Lab was, DiPietro and Molinar are liars. They have made this up. And even though it was in their own, the NASA photo catalogs, the image was in the NASA photo catalogs, and, we even found it in a photo mosaic of published in 1979, when DiPietro and Molinar had already, published before DiPietro and Molinar actually went to press. They found a, we found a scientific article with 7813 and the face and the pyramid right in the middle of a photo mosaic. You have to look for it. But so we had this almost Alice in Wonderland mad tea party. There is no additional picture. This is nonsense. Let us move on to real science.
And well, that's such a very good way of putting it, because they brought out some big guns. I mean, you obviously have a higher opinion of Carl Sagan than I do. He appears in the book now and then, and it's a very interesting anecdote, because my own sort of research has been on Paleolithic star lore and that kind of thing. So Carl Sagan is a person who tends to flip-flop, was a person who tends to flip-flop based on presumably what certain paymasters would like him to say. And you have a very interesting anecdote.
Well, we're all subject to that to some extent, Gordon.
To some extent, I would say you're brave, though.
Because I've heard the admonition, Brandenburg, shut your mouth and earn your gold.
Yeah.
More than once in my career.
Well, this is going to be, there's a story you describe in Death on Mars where Carl rings you up and he's, because, you know, you have these images that he thinks would be interesting. I think they were the Utopia images. And you, so you send them out, you know, you do the right thing. Of course, I will send these off. And he never got them. And you both know.
No, he never did.
And you both know what that means. You are both aware.
Well, we both, I had, it was almost a comical episode when I had arrived at I had taken a new position in Washington, D.C., at a defense contractor, aerospace contractor, and I had just started there. We were frantically running around selling research projects on the new SDI, or Strategic Defense Initiative, the space-based defense, which I believed in very fervently. And basically, I keep getting calls. Carl Sagan has called. I had a particularly lovely office manager. I was always pleased when she would walk up to me and say, Dr. Brandenburg, Carl Sagan has called for you. And so I would always call his office back. We would play what was called telephone tag in those days, since no one had cell phones or even beepers. And this went on for 2 weeks until finally I was in a conference with my boss. We were, you know, making a research proposal to the Pentagon. And we were planning that, and the lovely office manager, Darlene, walks into his office and says, John has a phone call. And the boss is extremely irritated and says, who is it from? And she says, it's from Carl Sagan. And he's awestruck at this, because Carl Sagan was a, you know, major media figure at the time. And here he is calling for, you know, to talk to this new employee who had some difficulties involving Mars in his last job. And then she says, and he's being snippy. And so my boss just laughs. Well, John better talk to him then. So I go and talk to him, and I had sent him the new pictures from Utopia, which show two new faces. One that looks just like the face in Cydonia. These are all those pictures, the discovery pictures, and the new confirmatory pictures from the later space probes are now shown in the book, Death on Mars. And so I go to the office, and here I am speaking with him privately, and I said, well, what did you think of the new pictures? And he said, I never got them. And we both do this long moment of silence, recognizing that the U.S. government is now involved in this, and they want us to know they're involved.
This is honestly, Dr. Brandenburg, this is a classic Skeptico story, because you have media-friendly science mouthpieces that stick to an agenda.
Now back to my conversation with Gordon.
The point is that the folks who are in charge of the machine believe it's true, and at the same time, they are engaged in a rigorous disinformation campaign to say exactly the opposite, right? So they
Correct.
Believe it, and at the same time, they're just as strongly as possible doing everything they can to discredit anyone who says that that's what they believe and to misinform the public and all that. So it is this kind of crazy world.
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the things, which maybe this can be edited to immediately afterwards, one of the things I found interesting, Dr. Brandenburg isn't as familiar with Jacques Vallée as I am, but few people are, because, you know, I would have a little statue of him in candles if I could. His experience as alongside the very famous Blue Book report in the 60s and 70s, into J. Allen Hynek's sort of review of the UFO phenomena. His experience with that, and his first time going to Washington after he'd sort of had Passport to Magonia published in J. Allen Hynek's tow, everyone in the CIA and whatever who he was speaking to had his book in their briefcase. Now, for immediately, that was very dismaying for him, because he suddenly realized he knew more than they did. They're carrying his book around and they're asking him questions. The second thing that he quickly realized over the next sort of several years is that one of the ways the sort of insidious component of the disinfo that comes with this policy is they outsource the research. And I think when Dr. Brandenburg says, quote-unquote, they want this information out. If they did, I would suggest they go to the New York Times. What they've done is given it to brilliant, rigorous, oddball groups because, I mean, you've run a P&L. You know what it's like. You don't want the dog project on your books, but you do need the research anyway. And that was Dr. Vallée's conclusion to why FBI agents would show up to a UFO conference in the middle of nowhere. They're not there in some kind of mysterious way that maybe someone's burst out with some secrets. They're actually there because we're in an area where we have to outsource the research because the disinfo component that comes with the national security implications makes it very difficult to otherwise navigate.
And what's interesting about that is if you listen carefully to this interview, at least what I heard was actually a realization by Brandenburg that that was going on. I don't think he had really quite thought of it in that way. And then you kept repeating that, outsourcing the research a couple times. And then he said, yeah, they outsourced the research to me. And then when it was time, as the story goes, you know, then it comes time to publish it. He doesn't even know to publish it. And they give him the signal. The signal is nothing information. And he still doesn't catch on. So then they nudge him a little bit further and they go, you know, you really ought to publish that. And he still isn't quite kind of caught on to it, which relates back to this other thing. And again, not to disparage Dr. Brandenburg, but as part of that script of outsourcing the research, a lot of times what they'll do is, and you know this better than I do, so jump in here, but they will target people that are somewhat imperfect in certain ways that would make them a vehicle to tell the story and also a vehicle that tells the story in a way that they can undermine or discredit or distance themselves from.
I didn't get to talk about this with Dr. Brandenburg, but I think it's his faith. I think the fact that he is an up-and-down Christian and makes no bones about it and mentions this in his presentation, and I completely respect that. But that's the thing the materialists will kind of stab at and go, oh, look, Charlie Church thinks there's aliens on Mars.
Right, exactly.
And it doesn't matter that he's a proper scientist. He got all the degrees and experience you want. He's a Christian, and I think that's why he gets to be kind of the nexus of some of the Mars atmospheric research, because he's got a really easy knife hole in his back already.
So the third point that I kind of outlined that I thought we might kind of kick around is this idea. I jotted down the idea, you know, the first rule of Fight Club. First rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club. And in Brandenburg's case, what's just fascinating about this interview, and if you're not careful, it doesn't even seem like it's the focus of the interview, but for me, it was one of the really big payoffs are these stories about how the game is really played. And we were just alluding to that just a minute ago when we were saying, you know, outsourcing the research. I mean, that's how the game is played. The junior college professor who, I mean, tell that story. Yeah. They will have heard this story probably because we'll leave it after the interview. But let's emphasize that. It's just a jaw dropper.
I kind of wonder if, and I assume he did, I wonder if he thought, if Dr. Brandenburg himself thought he was going crazy when halfway through this research, because I certainly do. I think wondering if I'm going crazy keeps me sane. I'm sure it's sort of very similar for you, Alex. And when he was in Washington, one of his close friends at the time who was interested in the Mars research pretended to be a community college astronomy professor.
Here's that actual story from Gordon's interview with Dr. John Brandenburg.
So we were both waiting for a tap on the shoulder. But since Vince had already encountered this and he had received no tap on the shoulder, it was basically the government wanted us to know that they were aware of our research.
Well, absolutely. Tell the story of Larry from community college.
Oh, fabulous. Yes, and many people were kind of interested in our work, many scientists, and would call us occasionally and even accompany us to scientific conferences. And eventually, a group of scientists formed the Society for Planetary SETI Research. And one of these scientists who was very interested was a local astronomy professor at a community college, whom I'll just call Larry. He's a good guy. I've gotten to know him. I've had a few beers with him. He's a good fellow, more than a few, over the years. And he was constantly chumming around with us and would go to conferences with us, and we were constantly sharing everything we found. We considered that there were no secrets at this point. We were just sharing what we had found, and we were documenting it by going to conferences and presenting it. And finally, we're downtown in Washington, D.C., at a conference about going to Mars. Carl Sagan later showed up, and we both, Vince DiPietro and I, both shook hands with him. And, we had a brief but cordial meeting there. But as we're standing there in the hallway outside in between talks, an Air Force colonel walks up who apparently Vince DiPietro had known, says hello to Vince. Vince introduces me. And then before Vince can introduce Larry, the colonel basically says, "Larry, good to see you here. How are things at Defense Intelligence Agency?" And Larry was a real pro. He didn't even bat an eyelash. He says, they're just going great, Colonel. Thank you for asking." And what I realized then is if there was going to be a tap on the shoulder, we would have already felt it. Instead, they were basically, by not interfering, waving us ahead. And the NASA data center at Goddard, which is in Washington, D.C., Goddard Space Flight Center, was very generous in providing us with all sorts of data. So we were basically being encouraged public. So there was a great game was going on, as Rudyard Kipling used to call it, the great game.
Absolutely. I don't know if you've read Dr. Vallée's recently published his journals in three volumes, Forbidden Science. And a similar thing happened in the 60s and 70s with ufology, which is essentially outsourcing research. Whoever is interested in the sort of independent research going on, they don't go to too much trouble to conceal that interest, and to the point where when Dr. Vallée would go to Washington, they would have his books, like Challenge to Science, in their briefcase, which he found a bit dismaying because it meant that he knew more than they did. So much for the government conspiracy. But the model was to...
I did not believe in UFOs at the time when I began my Mars research. I had basically adopted the view that if I'm working for the government and the government says there's no UFOs, therefore, since I want to be accepted as a serious scientist, I should not, I should just accept the conventional wisdom. In graduate school, we were actually told at one point, if anyone asks you if warp drive, like in the movie, in the show Star Trek, is possible, you're to say absolutely not. Nothing can go faster than light, et cetera, et cetera. We were actually recruited in graduate school to defend mainstream scientific views, and were expected to portray that to the public if anyone asked us. So I actually basically said, well, the government investigated UFOs and there was nothing to it, despite having seen some UFOs when I was a kid. It got a report in the paper. Everyone saw it over my town. But there was a great deal of scientific orthodoxy and discipline imposed on people who were part of the academia and part of government science that we weren't supposed to believe in certain things. Even talking about big things like Bigfoot, up in the woods, this could get you a reputation for not being a serious scientist. And then, of course, you're going to get passed over at the next job interview. And so, I had actually, by the time I was investigating Mars, I did not believe there was anything to the UFO phenomenon. And it was partly because I thought I want to be taken seriously as a scientist, and, you know, that is a forbidden subject. And so what happened then later was that the people in the UFO field recognized that finding a dead civilization on Mars very much confirmed the, you know, what's called the ET hypothesis, that the core phenomenon of UFOs is extraterrestrial. And so I would go to UFO conferences finally and give papers on Mars, which everyone loved. And I would look around, since I was also working closely with the Pentagon and intelligence agency and all these other agencies on the Star Wars thing. It would show up at meetings. And I would look around at these conferences and realize that half of the people at this conference looked like they're from various intelligence agencies. In fact, they're in fact subsidizing the conference by all of them buying tickets.
Well, yeah, that's essentially, that was Dr. Vallee's hypothesis as well, which is what you have here is an outsource of research. And I think that's what happened with the...
Hilarious.
Yeah, I think that's what happened with you. I think that's what happened with the independent Mars researchers, because this stuff is strategically important, and it's too hot to have government money attached to it. So this is how you do it.
So next, Gordon and I talk a little bit about that data versus the interpretation of that data. That data being that the government really is doing this stuff. And the interpretation of that data being, well, whatever you want it to be.
That's absolutely the skeptical angle, because those are our data. The interpretations of the data are that there are vanished, presumably vanished cultures on other planets in the solar system. I think that's a very good interpretation. I go about halfway there. But the actual data we are working with here is that we have an extremely dissociative space research policy in the West, where we're pretending it's one thing and actively believing and spending untold, you know, billions pursuing this idea that at least at some stage in the universe, in the solar system's recent history, it was a lot more interesting than it is today.
I'd add, as we talk about that Mars Death Star hypothesis kind of thing that is the core of Brandenburg's conclusion, to me, in a way, it does connect with some of the stuff that I've looked at in terms of near-death experience and spirituality in general, in that we cross the chasm to where we can't really even grasp conceptually what that means. And I kind of felt the same way here. When we're talking about 500 million years ago, a civilization being destroyed, and it totally throws out all our understanding of who we are, of our relationship to other beings and intelligence. It's like, you know, I can't really go there in any kind of way that makes sense. There's just too much. But at the same time, the adventure of leading up to the chasm is certainly an awesome one. And that's what I think he brought us with this interview, whether people want to jump to that other side and say, yep, somebody wiped out Mars 250 or 500 million years ago or not, is also very interesting to speculate about.
Okay, in this final segment from Gordon's interview, he talks to Dr. John Brandenburg about his theory and about his very solid data, it would seem, that supports this idea that Mars was destroyed by a nuclear blast.
Dr. Brandenburg, what is Xenon 129?
Xenon 129 is one of the five or so stable isotopes of xenon. In other words, it lasts forever. And one of the interesting things about nuclear fission is it creates principally two isotopes, like strontium-90 and also iodine-137. These are two very nasty isotopes, because one gets in your bones, the other one gets in your thyroid after a nuclear explosion, and they cause cancer later. And so, but a whole spectrum of isotopes are produced in a nuclear explosion that involves a lot of nuclear fission. And however, by looking at the distribution of xenon isotopes that are produced in the reactions, you can actually tell a great deal about the physics, the detailed physics of the nuclear reactions. And as it turns out, fast neutrons associated with nuclear explosions or plutonium production produce a great deal of xenon-129. And this is sort of a open secret, let's say. It is not a classified thing per se, but the government is bashful about confirming it. However, it's very easy to see in the atmosphere of the Earth. If you take atmospheric measurements of the xenon isotopes in the Earth's atmosphere, they look very much like the same that you get from the solar wind, from Jupiter, meteorites, all have the same kind of basic distribution. One is a peak at 129, the other is a peak at 132. These are the atomic numbers of the isotopes, and they're both stable. That's what everything in the solar system looks like. However, if you look at the change, there's been a change in the Earth's atmosphere since 1945, and almost all of that change is xenon-129. And this is due to open-air nuclear testing and the production of plutonium, which has to be done with fast neutrons. A regular nuclear reactor producing power uses slow neutrons because that's the way to maximize the fission reactivity of the uranium. They use slow neutrons, but if you're making nuclear weapons or setting them off, you use fast neutrons because it's an explosion or near so. So what happened is that they published the data on the shortly after landing on Mars and sampling the Mars atmosphere. They actually published this data on the Earth's atmosphere showing the spike in xenon. And so what happened is the U.S. government landed on Mars, sampled the Martian atmosphere where almost all the xenon is 129. It's different than any other planet or meteorite or anything else that we've sampled. They knew instantly after making that atmospheric sample that there had been a vast nuclear explosion on Mars, a very violent release of nuclear energy with fast neutron physics had occurred on Mars.
So we have a xenon range that is observable in the entire solar system. We have xenon 129, which is not naturally occurring, is exclusively a weapon signature, and we have.
Let's say it's normally equal to xenon 132 in its distribution. When you get a large excess of xenon 129 versus, you can basically ratio xenon 129 to xenon 132, that's what tells you it's a weapon signature.
Gotcha. And we know that because we have atmospheric samples from before we were using nuclear weapons on Earth, where we have a kind of normal ratio between these two. And then we have the subsequent one after 1945 and then on since, with the amount of kind of bombs we've dropped and plutonium we've weaponized on this planet. And we find that exact same, well, not the exact same. We actually find a more alarming ratio, if I've read you correctly, but we find that same,
absolute predominance of xenon 129 in the change of the atmosphere.
So to be clear, let's just put that together with the stuff we've been talking about over the course of the last hour. The sort of Western space program began in earnest with the belief or strong supposition that there were artificial structures on Mars.
Yes.
Over the course of that discovery, you have things like armed guards showing up at photo labs. Move on, and over the course of that discovery,
and Wernher von Braun suggesting the archaeologists should be sent to Mars in the
absolutely.
First mission.
We also find out that Mars was Earth-like. And you yourself had something to do with that.
By the way, that's why it's red. We'll get to that in a minute.
We will. And then we find out.
The big clue is that Mars was like Earth in the past, is not only the river channels, but its very redness.
Yeah. And then we find out that it has a, what's left of its atmosphere, but it has an atmospheric signature that is associated with weapons. It has a weapon signature in its atmosphere.
Yes.
And that's what you found.
That's right. And sent by subsequently, we have now found that the other shoe on the distribution is krypton, another inert gas. When it has a specific distribution of isotopes favoring light isotopes, that is actually also a signature of it's a secondary.
Yeah, it's a confirmation.
Secondary piece of evidence. It's like finding the bullet in the wall, and then oh yes, here's the shell casing from the gun that was, you know, from the cartridge that was fired. You found the bullet. That's the Xenon-129. There should be a shell casing around here. That's the krypton isotopes. Yes, and yes, they verify.
See, that's an excellent analogy. So that's an excellent analogy, because what I know people listening are thinking is, how have you run down the options? There must be some, even just for doing, you know, proper scientific diligence, Dr. Brandenburg, are there genuinely any other naturally occurring reasons for this ratio and the presence of krypton according to anyone you've spoken to or anyone, a nuclear physicist or anyone who has attempted to challenge your data? Because you looked, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Certainly when putting forth such an extraordinary hypothesis, you want to make sure as a scientist that your ducks, I care very deeply about my reputation as a scientist. And I will also tell you that I'm a veteran of many scientific disputes that I've actually been in the center of, and I've won almost every one of them. I'm used to winning these, what sometimes becomes brawls in the scientific in the alley. I'm a two-fisted scientist who's not afraid to step out in the alley over these things, and I'm used to winning, but I'm very careful. I'm very careful. I've waited. I've known of this possibility for 30 years. It's taken me that long to basically make certain of the evidence, find the evidence, make certain of it. But, you know, all we can ultimately do is take our best shot. I was not on Mars when all this happened. I don't really know. But we can surmise there was a very violent nuclear explosion on Mars from this evidence. The xenon, the krypton, plus other, we found a big radioactive scar on Mars of when you irradiate the ground in a nuclear explosion with neutrons, it makes the potassium an element, a widespread element on Earth. It makes that a radioactive, and it stays radioactive for it has a half-life of roughly a billion years, so it has a very long memory. And so if you had a big nuclear explosion, you would see a large area of Mars slightly above normal radioactivity in potassium, because it's a long-lived isotope, and that's in fact what we find. We found that in its near Cydonia.
Yeah, well, we're about to get to some of the more alarming parts of it, but I just want to make sure that
we really nail
the objections that people might have, which is you're still leaving the door open. Basically, what we have, the best interpretive model for the atmospheric and sort of soil data on Mars, the best one available is that this is the result of an ancient nuclear explosion. You're perfectly okay with, you know, 20 years down the track, it turns out that there's some kind of crazy, bearing in mind you're a plasma physicist, so I was about to say some kind of crazy, weird plasma event in space that could cause it. I think it's probably not that.
There's always the possibility of some unknown natural phenomenon, but the only known phenomenon, unfortunately it's not natural, but it is not a natural phenomenon, but it's certainly a well-known phenomenon, is the explosion of a very large nuclear device. In a standard hydrogen bomb now in the arsenals of all of the nations of Earth, they take a hydrogen bomb and then to boost its yield, they double its yield by wrapping it in uranium so that the fast neutrons from the fusion reaction go out and split even normally inert uranium-238. The reaction is so violent and the neutrons are so powerful, they even can fission, they can even fission lead. So what they did is they wrapped the hydrogen bomb in uranium or thorium or a mixture of the two. They generally prefer uranium because it's more reactive. And this doubles the yield of the hydrogen bomb. So you actually have a fission triggering a fusion reaction. The fission the small atomic bomb triggers the hydrogen bomb reaction, and then the hydrogen bomb in turn triggers a very large fission reaction, which actually is half of the energy of the total yield. And so it just by changing the material of the jacket of the bomb, you double the yield. And it creates an enormous amount of nuclear fallout, which then would poison all life. Fusion by itself doesn't create that much residual or radioactivity that's harmful to life. That's why the neutron bomb was almost a pure fusion bomb. It was supposed to be very clean and tidy. But when you wrap the bomb in to boost what's called fission boosting its yield, it makes it very dirty, and it will. So the blast, the initial radiation will kill everything. It'll blow the atmosphere off Mars, and then the fallout from this enormous nuclear weapon will poison all remaining advanced life on Mars. Nothing but primitive life will survive. And life that stays deep in the soil.
Yeah. And why are there, this is where it gets a bit alarming. Why are there no craters from these events on Mars?
Oh, well, you look at you basically, here, Gordon, is what you have. You have evidence for the enormous nuclear explosion on Mars, evidence for past Earth-like conditions, evidence for what appears to be, based on an Earth reference, a primitive civilization. However, its technological level is unknown. It appears, based on the artifacts we find, it resembles ancient Egypt. So you find Mars was like Earth in every way. It was even inhabited. Then there was this big nuclear explosion. Then you find the radioactive scar near Cydonia. You find a smaller one, roughly maybe 20% of the yield of the first one, near Utopia, where we found the other two faces. And somebody asked me, well, why did you go from nuclear physics then back to these artifacts? And I said, because I can read a map. It's a rare talent nowadays with everybody using GPS, but I said, I can read a map. I know the radioactive scar is here. Here is Cydonia, just downwind of it, with the prevailing Coriolis winds on Mars. And here is the other scar, and it's just upwind of Utopia, or rather, it's actually called Galaxis Chaos. That's its official name. This is a name picked by NASA, not by me. So the fallout from these two nuclear weapons would have gone directly downwind to poison everything that survived the initial blast at Cydonia and Utopia. So, but there's no crater at either spot. This means it was an airburst. There's no craters at Hiroshima or Nagasaki, and that's because everyone knows that if you want to inflict maximum damage on light civilian structures, you set off your nuclear weapon in midair. This maximizes the shock damage. If you set it off on the ground, most of the energy goes into the ground and digs a big crater. But that localizes the damage. If you want the damage to be more widespread, and more ferocious, then you go for the intense shockwave in the air, and that means an airburst. So this is standard doctrine as illustrated by how the nuclear weapons were employed in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, unfortunately. And so this means that whoever did this, this looks like standard employment of a nuclear weapon using basic laws of physics to maximize damage against civilian areas. And then you say, well, if it was a nuclear war on Mars involving the Martians, they would have just fired a whole bunch of little weapons. They wouldn't have blown up their entire planet. Especially, why loft a big weapon into midair, which must have weighed as much as the Empire State Building, when just setting it off on the ground would have been sufficient? And that's where you realize, oh, the Martians did not do this to themselves. So you're basically led by the evidence to a very specific, frightening scenario. That is that someone else, we know we're not alone in the universe. We know there are many intelligent species out there. Two of these extraterrestrial intelligences interacted on Mars. There was an indigenous species on Mars, apparently, that built a primitive civilization. Someone else came along and dropped two very large nuclear weapons on Mars, apparently to sterilize the planet. They wanted to do a Death Star on this thing. We're talking someone like the Daleks or Governor Tarkin in Star Wars, who is asked, well, you know, why hit Alderaan? He says, well, the other planet you specified, Tatooine, is too remote to be a good example.
Yeah.
Doing this to set an example, perhaps, to
potentially
the species.
Yeah. Like, yes, I want to be clear. Yeah. Because your evidence, your actual data are so good and so compelling. I want to be clear that segment of the show.
Yes, we are led to a specific dreadful scenario.
Yeah,
of
but
a
this
primitive
is—it's an interpretation.
Wiped out by a spacefaring species.
Yes, because I want to play devil's advocate on that for in a bit, but I just want to illustrate for the listeners that the data stops at nuclear airburst, nuclear. That's where it stops. That's where, and so we look at the data we have and go, okay, now we need to interpret this. And your interpretation is one of a sort of broadly Bronze Age, a culture on Mars being destroyed, by another culture. It's a good interpretation. I need some convincing.
Now, by the way, Gordon, I'm well enough, experienced enough scientist to know there may be some strange esoteric plasma ball lightning falling out of space from some solar storm, but we have never seen anything like this.
Absolutely not. And what we have seen is nuclear weapons.
We have been observing space, and we have been observing space since the Middle Ages. Anything like that occurred in the solar system, we would have seen it and made note of it. Nothing like that has ever, there is no known natural phenomenon that can account for this. Unfortunately, the only known phenomenon is what we have created on Earth with our own hydrogen bomb explosions.
Absolutely.
And they were a lot of them were airbursts.
When we come to the interpretation piece, however, I mean, here's a devil's advocate one for you. I'm not I'm not sure. The Bronze Age thing is a guess. It's a good one given what's left. I mean, you and I would both agree the next step would be to actually go and look. Yeah. Like, we will only know if we go and look, which we should, obviously. But by this, I mean, even if they were, because we're talking based on your interpretation of the half-life here, we're talking 250 billion years ago to maybe half a billion, but before they were humans.
Yeah, about half a billion. I would guess about half a billion years ago.
Yeah. Which means even if they were Bronze Age, they would have been here by now. They would have got here by now and we wouldn't exist. So
exactly. We would be Martians.
Well, we wouldn't exist, which actually, this is kind of the devil's advocate piece. So maybe the bombs were a mercy. If you look at it that way, maybe the bombs were a mercy. Maybe you're dealing with a species that looks at time differently. It's a hypothetical. I'm putting it out there.
Yes. When you bring in the idea of intelligence and technology, the possibilities just become myriad.
They do.
There's just an infinite range of possibilities. You know, I write science fiction, so I can kind of be in touch with that range of possibilities.
Yeah.
And but based on known phenomenon, this is the interpretation we arrive at with a fairly high degree of confidence. But we have to go there. We have to send people there to dig through the ruins and find out what exactly happened. You know, was there some prior encounter under this hypothesis? Did the species that destroyed Mars come to Mars and say, we would like to colonize part of your planet. Please give us permission. And the Martians perhaps said, hell no.
Or was it like Minority Report? Did they see that the Martians would actually become an even more dangerous interplanetary species? Your first encounter with this data, just to come back to the nuclear physicists who actually look at it and see this as self-evident, your first encounter was in a queue for a Xerox machine, I believe, with this information. Is that correct?
Yes, I was working at a government laboratory where nuclear weapons were designed, built, you know, for testing. They were the main kind of – they handled the engineering aspects of nuclear weapons for both production and deployment, but also for, you know, if Lawrence Livermore Lab, where I went to school, designs a hydrogen bomb, then they would send it to Sandia Labs as, you know, please build this. And Sandia Labs would work out all of the, you know, the details of what size bolts to use on it, et cetera, et cetera. These things are important. And, you know, the devil's in the details, even in a hydrogen bomb. And so Sandia Labs had a very good reputation for being extremely competent. And they also ran several programs, and I only found this later. They were involved also in atmospheric monitoring. They monitored Earth's atmosphere to look for various isotopes to see, for one thing, if somebody else sets off a hydrogen bomb underground and then the gases leak to the surface, eventually it will change if you have very sensitive monitoring in the atmosphere, you can detect this, that there has been a nuclear test someplace, and you can estimate its yield, et cetera, et cetera. So, as I'm standing in line, in those days, everything, Xerox machines were very, very important. And so I'm standing in line to Xerox a Mars article about the isotopes in the Mars, atmosphere. I wasn't really very interested in the xenon and krypton isotopes on Mars. I was basically interested in the nitrogen, oxygen, carbon that indicated that Mars had lost a considerable amount of its atmosphere from the past. And so I was chatting with this fellow as we're standing in line to use the Xerox machine, and I mentioned Xenon-129. I said, oh, and also the Xenon-129 on Mars is very peculiar. It's much different than our Earth or in the meteorites or in the solar wind from the sun. And he does this big double take. He raises his eyebrows. He's a very genial kind of technical fellow, just kind of got projected the image of just being an all-around serious science, you know, hardworking scientist. And he does this, he loses his smile and he says, could I see that? And he looks at the data presented in the scientific article. It was the book Scientific Results of the Viking Expedition, and showed the distribution of xenon-129 relative to, like, Earth. And he just tells me, he hands the book back to me, and he says, someone nuked them. Then he just nods. And then he looks around a little bit and says, looks like he's becoming uncomfortable, and he realizes he's in an unclassified part of the laboratory. It's the library. He shouldn't be speaking of such things in such an area. So he just excuses himself. He puts down his book that he was going to Xerox, and he just leaves. And it's quitting time. You know, the place is getting darker, and they're turning off lights and stuff. So I just realized, oh, he just told me something that is classified or confidential, and he shouldn't be talking about that in an open, uncleared area like this. And this happened periodically. I was admonished once, John, you shouldn't say that word in this area because it's a term, you know, that is for a classified process or something. And it was just, I prided myself on being very good about security matters.
Well, yeah, that was going to be the last piece. I mean, if that's the beginning of your kind of story of investigating the bombs, when you were confident enough in it, you sent it to the Pentagon.
I didn't know enough about nuclear physics at the time. I was trained as a plasma physicist, basically electromagnetism.
Yeah. Well, let's jump to the end of it, because I think this is quite important. For other people to understand. Once you had actually run down, from this beginning moment, once you'd actually run down the other possibilities of what this could be, you actually submitted your research to the Pentagon beforehand. Tell us about that.
Yes. Once I learned enough about nuclear physics, Vince DiPietro urged me to contact the Pentagon and tell them. He basically said, John, we have to come forth with this. And I thought, well, we have to contact the Pentagon first to see if it's classified, because I had a security clearance. I didn't want to violate anything, And so I called Larry, our basically government informant. I figured, well, he's obviously sent here by somebody who's interested in this stuff. So I called Larry in, and Larry came to the place where I was working, and we reserved the conference room for about an hour, and I gave him a full briefing. And he took careful notes and appeared fascinated. This all appeared to be news to him. And then he said, okay, I will report this at the Defense Intelligence Agency. So he did. And we didn't hear anything then for like 6 months. And then a friend of mine who I had grown up with, who also, he worked for Office of Naval Intelligence. So he was part of the defense intelligence world. And he and I would just get together socially because we'd grown up together and we were both working in Washington, D.C. We were having, sitting on his the porch of his very pleasantly situated house in Northern Virginia, looking out over his lawn and having a few beers. And he said, John, that nuclear stuff you found on Mars, you should really publish that. No, in fact, he did put it that way. He said, why don't you publish that? And from talking with him earlier, I knew that he was very much informed on all of these matters, and he remains my good friend. So I just said, okay, I'll do it. And then I had to figure out how to get it into the literature so it wouldn't be immediately rejected, and I opted for the idea that it was a natural nuclear reactor on Mars that had gone unstable and had a fast, had done a Chernobyl. So that got accepted, but people who actually were at the conferences told me, they said, well, the xenon spectrum is wrong. That's not a unstable nuclear reactor. That's a bomb. So I gradually then was able to ascertain that it could not have been a natural nuclear explosion. Besides, a natural nuclear explosion would have left a big crater on Mars. And so I that's how I basically got it into the literature. We basically reported it to the Pentagon in their characteristic fashion of covering their tracks. Everything was kind of done unofficially. They said, go ahead and publish. So I did, first as a natural event on Mars, which then did not fit the data. I almost wanted to believe it myself, you know, that it was a natural event, a freak natural event. This is Mars, after all. But I was forced back to the original conclusion that this was the destruction of Mars by somebody else, somebody much more advanced from space.
And that's actually quite a good place to draw this to a close.
With all that that implies about our own place in the universe, by the way.
Absolutely. Jordan. And that's a very...
Here we are playing, we're holding a rock concert in the abandoned ghost town that is the universe. We're holding a rock concert and having a big bonfire. Anyone who wants to find us can find us.
All right, so now people are going to have to go and buy your book, Dr. Brandenburg, or otherwise they won't get to sleep. They won't get to sleep after
that. We have to go to Mars.
Let's go to Mars. Also, yeah. Brilliant. All right, so where might they go to find your books?
Well, you can go to my website, lifeonmars.pub. Just think of a good English pub. And so lifeonmars, one word, .pub, has all of the data, the latest data. And I will be going to another scientific conference. I've had a paper accepted to speak on this, so I'm going to go do that. I'm being, you know, basically waved ahead. The government wants this to come out. Not officially, but it wants it to come out.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, all this information and the links to the books and everything will be in the show notes, of course. So, Dr. Brandenburg, this has been fascinating. Thank you very much for your time, and good luck presenting the paper.
Thank you very much. And also, of course, there's Death on Mars, the book, available on Amazon.com. So, Death on Mars.
Wonderful. Thanks once again.
Gordon, thank you so much for having me on your show. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So next, Gordon and I wrap things up.
It was a real joy to speak to Dr. Brandenburg about his research because the atmospheric information or his interpretation, it's not even interpretation, the atmospheric data speak for themselves. But outside of that, it's almost like NDE stuff because it is a data point that invites you to speculate about the kind of nature or story of the universe in a way that I hope people like listen to the interview and sit with the fact that at the moment, that is the best hypothesis as to who did it and why and so on. As I said to Dr. Brandenburg, because he has I don't want to say melodramatic, but his view of what happened on Mars is his own. It has nothing to do with his data. But like it could have been a planet of pedophiles. Like we don't actually know, right? Yeah.
Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah, back to the... That's the thing. I mean, once you start down that path of a speculation, I mean, there's just no end to it. It could have been an accident, you know. It could have been a huge
accident, mistake.
Accident,
it could have been, from a kind of magical perspective, I think the destruction of Mars has something to do with us on Earth. As I said to Dr. Brandenburg, because he's like, oh, you know, the universe has people that destroy other civilizations. And I said, we would not be here if someone hadn't bombed Mars. Mars would have got here and we wouldn't exist. So I don't know how, and that's my speculation, obviously. That has nothing to do with the data. But these data invite quiet consideration immediately followed by drinks and thrashing ideas around.
Right. You talk about a you can't handle the truth moment. Digest that one that you just said. You know, what if at the end of the day, okay, yeah, that's horrible. You wouldn't be here unless it happened. Which I don't know. It's just fun to speculate on that. So we'll kind of leave it at that. The one tiny bit I was going to add there is that there really isn't a lot of controversy around the hard data that he's found and the difference of these isotopes. And it's so telling from a kind of skeptico versus the pseudo-skeptic standpoint is, go, folks, look at
the pseudo-skeptics who attack this and see if they ever attack that. They don't touch it. They don't touch. They do not. It's all personal attack. It's all sneering and giggling and all this. Tell us about the isotopes. Tell us about the plasma physics. His interpretation of that remains unchallenged.
I couldn't find anyone who said otherwise. And a credit to him as a scientist, because I sort of was really pulling on it going, is there any even sort of theoretical plasma event you could think of on paper that the sun or something could do that could have triggered it? And he's like, well, it is always possible. But the reality is we have no idea how that would work. We haven't seen it anywhere else in the universe at all. As for our available data, the fact that it is a weapon signature in the Martian atmosphere is simply the best match. And we have our own planet, the before and after of using nuclear bombs, both in testing and in war. We have that as our, A/B test to show that this is what a weapon signature looks like. But even at the end, he's like, look, it obviously could be. Where I think he's correct is we'd have to leave it at that. We'd have to leave it at, there could be a natural process that generates this particular fast-moving xenon-129 isotope in an atmosphere that we don't know yet. If it wasn't for the previous 70 years of policy towards Mars, so it's not a data point that stands alone. It's a data point that you put next to what we've just described, and you start to get a very that's interesting response.
That's a great point, and I think we'll end it there. We'll do a quick cut, and we'll figure out how to incorporate this in. And I will now invite Gordon White back to Skeptico. We've just finished up this interview, and Gordon, traditionally what I like to do is kind of throw out a question to the audience that they might want to wrestle around with a little bit, and I'm going to invite you on the spot. I didn't ask you really to prepare for this, so what is one question that you think we could dialogue about from this interview with the Skeptico audience? Does one or two come to mind?
Yeah, I think the classic Skeptico piece, once people have listened to the interview, is the role of Carl Sagan and the kind of public versus background science that was going on in the late 70s, early 80s is where kind of repositioning our ideas around it. That's what I want people to talk about, and also think about the implications of the fact that we rebooted his show with a similar mouthpiece very recently. It's that media-friendly science versus actual science and what people think about that in relation to space.
Perfect. So back to the agenda. Who's writing the script? Who's controlling the agenda? That's a great question and a great way to leave it. Gordon, again, thank you so much for bringing us this terrific interview and for sharing all these thoughts that you have with us about it. I think it's added a real sense of closure and a real sense of context to everything that Dr. Brandenburg said. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome, and a shout out to Dr. Brandenburg for his time as well. Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
So there you have it. Not a whole lot to add to that. Please do join me on the Skeptical Forum or send me a note if you'd like to comment on the questions that Gordon teed up from this interview. Of course, you can find out all the information you would want about Skeptico at our website, skeptiko.com. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you do, please share it with your friends, with everyone else. This, I think, is important information that I don't know is out there in any other way. So I sure hope you do take the opportunity to share this with someone who might be interested in it. I have a number of exciting shows coming up that I can't wait to bring to you. So do stick around for all of that. Until next time, take care. And bye for now.